I'd like to call this meeting of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee to order. The time is 1:33 p.m. We are in Belt's Room 105 of the Thomas Stewart Building in the nation's most beautiful capital city of Juneau, Alaska. Today is Friday, January 30th. Members present are Senator Dunbar, Senator Gray Jackson, Senator Yunt, and myself, Senator Bjorkman. I believe Senator Merrick will be joining us momentarily via the phone or Teams web. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Welcome, everyone, to Senate Labor and Commerce. I'd like to extend an especially warm welcome to our recording secretary, Carrie Tupo, and our LAO moderator, Renzo Moises. We have three items on our agenda today, so we will move at a brisk but business-like pace. First up, we have HB 78, Retirement Systems Defined Benefit Option. Followed by that will be Senate Bill 121, Health Insurance Allowable Charges, and rounding out our lineup today is Senate Bill 163, Repeal Certain Inactive Funds / Accounts. First up, we have House Bill 78, Retirement Systems Defined Benefit Option. We first heard this bill on Friday, January 23rd, when we had a presentation of the bill. We had following meetings the next two committee days where we adopted a committee substitute, took invited and public testimony. Today is my intention to have any committee discussion that members would like to engage in and then look to the will of the committee on the bill. Today we have the Honorable Representative Chuck Kopp with us here for questions and his trusty staff, Julia O'Connor. Are there any questions for Representative Kopp or Ms. O'Connor? Hearing and seeing none, is there any further committee discussion or comments on House Bill 78? Senator Yunt.
Thank you. Through the chair. So just wanted to put back on record that I mentioned this quite a bit last week, and so I'll be brief today. But I did like that the bill had the option to be, you could be in the DB or the DC plan. I like that there was 5 years there that somebody could choose. We have a lot of people move to Alaska, sometimes not planning to stay for the rest of their life, and they come up here and fall in love with the place. And so the type of people we're trying to attract are typically very talented. We're looking, you know, high-level individuals that have a good resume and could benefit the state in many ways, whether they're an engineer or an attorney or whatever it may be. So I do wish that that had been left in there, and I just want to put that on the record. But yeah, that's all. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Senator Yunt. Any additional comments by committee members? Hearing and seeing none, Senator Gray Jackson, may I have a motion, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I am eagerly moved to report House Bill 78, version 34, LSO 493, / Golf from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is there an objection? Hearing and seeing none, CS for HB 78 version 34-LS0493 / G as in Golovin is reported from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. We'll take a brief at ease while we sign the paperwork and set up for the next bill. We're back on the record now. It is 1:39 p.m., still in the same place, but we're moving on to our next item, Senate Bill 121. We have here to present the bill the Honorable Senator Kathy Geisel, as well as her staff, Ms. Jane Conway. Thank you for joining us in Senate Labor and Commerce.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Kathy Giesel. I represent in the Senate District E, which is the Anchorage Hillside down to Whittier. Today, I am speaking to you about Senate Bill 121. Thank you for hearing the bill. This bill is about health care, access, and affordability. Health care is a big topic this session, and this is a piece of that. I've been chasing this greased pig since 2018, trying to set a minimum reimbursement for clinicians. Last session, you heard this particular bill, Senate Bill 121, which requires a reimbursement rate for out-of-network providers to be at a certain amount of money. So just for reminder, and mainly possibly for the public, out-of-network means that a clinician has not contracted with an insurance company, Premera, Aetna, whoever, to provide services for those insured people. So let's take Aetna, for example. If you have Aetna insurance, that insurance company negotiates with clinicians on how much they'll pay the clinician for certain services. And those services are defined by codes that the clinician uses when they see you and provide the services. People who are not in that network can charge whatever they want, but the insurance company is not committed necessarily to paying them that amount. But this bill would set that amount and provide a negotiation point for clinicians who are in network. So in other words, if Jane is a clinic and I'm a clinic, I decide to be in network for Premera. So Premera is going to send me their insured patients. Jane, on the other hand, says, no, I'm going to go on my own. So the patient sees Jane, and maybe Jane charges $500 for a visit. I've contracted with the insurance company to provide that very same service. Perhaps it's an average visit, not particularly complicated. And I have negotiated with the insurer to be paid $400 for that visit. She's charging $500, I'm charging $400. The insurance company, with what we're providing here, we're setting that amount. She will be reimbursed at that $500. Let's just say that's the what the bill says, that she would be reimbursed at that $500. When I negotiate with the insurance company, I know what they're setting her reimbursement at. And so I can say, look, I'll do this for $450 or $400. I can negotiate. But if there's no set fee that out-of-state clinicians can be reimbursed for, or out-of-network, thank you, then I have nothing to negotiate. The insurance company can say, well, I'm going to give you $150 for that visit. Mm-hmm. So what we're trying to do here is set a standard for reimbursement for clinicians who are outside of network, but it provides a negotiating point for folks that decide to contract with that insurance company on what they'll be paid. It's a negotiation tool. So this bill had that in it. We still had something called the 75th percentile in it. The state used to have an 80th percentile rule. And we also had a separate bill that had a requirement for network adequacy. So that meant that, again, let's take Premera for an example. They had to provide those people who are buying their insurance with a diverse enough group of providers that they had some choice. So maybe Jane is a physician, a family practice physician. I'm a nurse practitioner. The insurance company can't say, I'm just going to have Jane. If you have our insurance, you can only see Jane and be covered by our insurance. If they come to see me, they'll have to pay out of pocket and then bill insurance themselves or whatever. So that was what the network adequacy piece of it was. We've taken those two pieces after discussion during interim, and we've created a CS that is before you that Jane is going to explain that CS. It combines these two concepts and deletes some other aspects of it, simplifying it. So if it's all right with you, Mr. Chairman, Jane could take you through an explanation of changes.
Okay. So before we do that, are there any questions from committee members about the concepts that were just explained by the member from the Hillside in South Anchorage? Seeing, hearing none. For just the quarter of course here in business, we will put the CS on the table. So members have in their packet a draft proposed CS. May I have a motion, please?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move CS for Senate Bill 121, version 34LS0282/golf as the working document. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'll object for purposes of explanation. Ms. Conway.
Good afternoon. My name is Jane Conway. I am staff to Senator Kathy Geisel, and I'd be happy to go over the changes from the version I that you had before you last session, I think April or May, to the new CS, which is version G. So version G adds a new section, 2107035, that outlines the minimum provider network standards to the bill, the network adequacy language that Senator Geisel referenced from a different bill last year, Senate Bill 122. Then Section 2 is really just formally Section 1 from Version I. So in that section, now with Section 2, that outlines the standards for settlement of health insurance claims. That section is amended by removing the verbiage from subsection A pertaining to the 75th percentile. So we removed that part of the section when we changed to version G. However, subsection A still contains the language for the 450% of the CMS fee schedule for Medicare. In other words, the floor reimbursement, and that remains in the bill as an allowable charge. Following that section in subsections B, C, and D, they are all the same from version I to G, so those have not changed. Then we have Section 3. It's a repeal of some language that is no longer needed because of the addition of the network adequacy language that is now covered in the bill. So repeal 2107-0203 is not needed anymore. Section 4 is the same transition language that was formerly Section 3 in version I. That's the same language now in version G. And then Section 5 is just the effective date. And we've upped it, of course, another year because another year is passing. And those are the changes from version I to G.
Thank you very much. Are there any objections, questions? Senator Young.
Health insurance is a very complicated issue, right? And so handled with delicacy, it's probably something that we'll always be looking at, no matter how good we make things. Probably always be a time to make it better, right? So can you just please, for everyone listening and for us, just give your explanation of how this is just going to make things better for the consumer and help keep costs down, but help keep the market stable too,
Access is a challenge in Alaska, and we actually have invited testimony, clinicians who practice today here in Alaska, and actually one who has had to leave Alaska because the reimbursement has fallen so much with the removal of the 80th percentile rule that happened a little over a year ago. So what this bill does is set that minimum reimbursement rate for out-of-network providers, which allows those who are in-network to have a negotiation arm, okay? They can go to the table and say, I'm going to arm wrestle you on this because I know you're paying her 450% of Medicare. I'll do the same work for 400% of Medicare. And they can bargain with it. Insurer may say, no, only 350%, whatever. but it gives them a bargaining point. Right now, there's no bargaining point. And that's best explained by our invited testimony. They can tell you that instead of having that bargaining point, the reimbursements have fallen significantly. The contracts have been canceled in many cases that providers had with insurance companies. And they're now reimbursing at about 185% of Medicare for the same services that they used to be paid significantly more. So it means that clinics are folding, clinicians are leaving. I'll let the invited testimony talk about that. So that's what we're trying to fix here, is to keep our clinicians here at a reimbursement rate that they can afford to keep their clinic open. The access part also includes the network adequacy. So this would prevent insurance companies from saying, in this town, there's the hospital you can go to for outpatient surgery, or there's a surgery center. And insurance companies could say, wait a second, we're only going to cover the services at the hospital. But network adequacy would require them to have multiple choices for people. So people might say, actually, I'd rather go over here to the surgery center. It's easier to get in and out of the building. It's quality care, whatever. But providing that diversity of clinicians. So, again, helping access. So that's what the bill is. You know, the network adequacy, I know it sounds new. It's actually something that there's a model legislation from the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, which I believe, Mr. Chairman, you've attended some of their conferences. 38% of other states have a network adequacy requirement. So that's how these go hand in hand to create a viable business environment for our clinicians. They're business people. They're trying to run a business as well as serve Alaskans.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Senator. We will move now. Any further objection to the CS? Hearing and seeing none, CS4, Senate Bill 121, version 3-4, LS0822/G, as in Galena, is adopted as a working document. We'll go now to your invited testifiers. First up, we have via the Teams web, Mr. Jeff Davis. Mr. Davis, please state your name and affiliation and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chairman Bjorkman and Senator Gray Jackson, Senator Dunbar, and Senator Young for the chance to speak with you today. My name is Jeffrey Davis, and I'm the owner and principal of Weston Group Consulting, LLC, and I'm here representing the Alaska State Medical Association and hopefully the larger medical community with my views. I'm quite familiar with these issues because I have 40 years of experience in healthcare and health insurance in Alaska, and 18 of that I was president of Premera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. And during my tenure with Premera, I had many discussions with the Division of Insurance about how to improve the 80th percentile regulation. We wanted to improve it, but we never suggested repeal without replacement, which is what happened. Because there were benefits from the regulation. Being familiar with this, I could talk with you for an hour, but I won't. I've tried to pare my comments down to as short as I could. But please ask questions if any of this doesn't make sense or if I've left out something that is important to you as you think about these matters. Senate Bill 121 is a consumer protection bill that replaces the protections that were in place for 20 years under the repealed 80th percentile regulation, plus, as Senator Giesel explained, proactively preventing access issues when narrow network products are eventually introduced in Alaska. Specifically, Senate Bill 121 does two main things. It ensures Alaskans get the health insurance benefits they paid for, and it helps protect access to physicians and other providers. So how does this bill ensure people get the benefits they paid for? As the Senator explained, insurers don't automatically pay based on the provider's charges. If there's no contract, someone decides if the charge is reasonable, quote unquote. And under the repealed regulation, there was a state-defined rule that was in place that would determine what was reasonable. But after repeal, the insurers were allowed to decide what was reasonable. And the largest chose a standard, which is about half of what was in place under the regulation. So in most cases, this means the insurer now pays much less than what it paid under the regulation, and the patient pays more. The value of the policy they bought is decreased. The consumer's not getting what they paid for. Senate Bill 121 reestablishes a state-determined rule for deciding what is reasonable charge, and that protects the consumer. So how does this bill protect access to providers? Well, there are three ways it does that. First, if a patient chooses a non-contracted provider, the insurance payment would be based on what's reasonable in Alaska, not what's been deemed to be reasonable based on some other lower-cost location. And that supports the patient's ability to choose the provider they think is going to be best for them. And second, this bill supports fair payment to providers, as you've just heard from Senator Giesel, by establishing what is reasonable based on the charges in Alaska, not an arbitrary fee schedule. And why does that matter? Well, fair payment is needed to keep physicians and other providers in Alaska. Many Alaska providers, as you'll hear today, are in financial trouble and in danger of closing their practices. And there are a number of reasons for that, but here are just a few. Insurance contract rates have been flat or gone down over the last few years. I shared a chart with you last year that illustrated that. Same time, Medicare rates are down by approximately 33%. And Medicaid rates, which used to be much higher than Medicare, are now equal to Medicare, so they've come down as well. And the portion of Medicare and Medicaid recipients in the population has grown as a percentage of the population. So in the face of declining or flat revenue sources, to make the problem worse, the cost of support staff is up 47% in the last 10 years, according to a study published last year by the Hospital Association. So the result of all this is the take-home pay for physicians in Alaska is amongst the lowest in the nation. In fact, for family practice, it is the lowest, based on a Medical Group Management Association survey from 2024, based on 200,000 responses. And the practices are struggling, and they're unable to recruit to replace providers into this sort of an environment who retire or who leave. This bill also promotes fair payment by bringing more balance to contract negotiations, as Senator Giesel explained. Before repeal, insurers would not agree to contract increases. They knew they had the upper hand, even before repeal. But after repeal, with increased bargaining power, now that the alternative to staying in-network is much, much lower, about half of what it was, they began demanding steep increases, as steep as 28%. So you have flatter declining revenue, you have skyrocketing expenses, and now you're being told that you need to deliver a huge decrease over what you have been getting. In other words, repeal without replacement weakened providers' negotiating power, and they were already the underdogs. And third, this bill, as you heard, proactively sets minimum network standards before narrow networks come to Alaska. The provisions in the bill apply to narrow network products. A narrow network is one that provides little or no payment for out-of-network providers. So the example Senator Giesel was giving, Jane's in, one provider out of two or three is chosen. The insured person must go to that provider or they receive no benefit at all or very little benefit. And since Alaska is starting at a place where it's, the entire state is a federally designated healthcare professional shortage area, to go from an already inadequate supply of providers to a subset of that would just make the situation worse and means patient choice could be severely impacted and access impacted. And insurers use narrow networks to drive down contract rates by pitting groups against each other. Group A, hey, you give us this rate, you're in, and we'll keep Group B out, or vice versa, which then also makes the situation worse. As Senator Giesel stated, the National Association of Insurance Commissioners has stated that has model legislation that has been adopted by 38 out of the 50 states and territories. Each has adopted some form, and they have stated, their Committee on Healthcare and Health Benefits has stated that network minimums are amongst the most important things a state can do to preserve a well-functioning healthcare and a health insurance market. So they're very important. The minimum standards proposed in Senate Bill 121 are different than in the other 38 states because they reflect the unique geography and distribution of people and providers in Alaska and, as mentioned, the already fragile state of the provider community. So action is needed now, as at least one of the major insurers has stated that they desire to bring narrow network products to Alaska. So in summary, Senate Bill 121 is needed to protect consumers' pocketbooks and access to needed health care. I thank you, committee members, and Chair Bjorkman, for your time and attention, and I'd be happy to take any questions you might have.
Thank you very much, Mr. Davis. Are there any questions from committee members? Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you again, Mr. Davis. And I know we've heard this bill. I had a chance to hear this bill in the Health Committee as well, I think. So we've heard it a number of times, but it has been, we've been gone for 6-7 months, and this is a combined bill now. Could you describe a little bit how the enforcement of the rules regarding narrow network would work?
Yes, I'd be happy to. Through the chair, Senator Dunbar. The way enforcement would work would be carried out by the Division of Insurance. When a carrier filed a product, they filed their narrow network products, they would have to demonstrate at that point in time to the Division of Insurance that they were meeting the standards in each of the minimum standards in each of the regions. If they were not able to meet them, there's provisions in the bill for a phase-in period to be allowed by the director of the division, as also are provisions that the director could make exceptions if there were reasons that the insurer could not meet the standards for at least for a period of time, make exceptions to that rule.
Follow, Mr. Chair.
Indeed.
Is that similar to how these kinds of bills have worked elsewhere? And I think it's worth reiterating, in a normal functioning market, companies can just bring a product and start selling it. But this is a highly regulated market, and so it's, am I right in saying that the insurers already have to go to the Division of Insurance, and have some sort of approval before they bring the product into market?
Yes, through the chair, Senator Dunbar, yes, that is correct. Insurers need to file, and the products need to be approved before they're able to use them in Alaska for insured regulated products.
And follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
And I'm sorry, that was a two-part question. The earlier part was, how have efforts like this worked in other states, or is the enforcement mechanism here similar to how it's been set up in other states?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, I am not familiar with all of them, but my understanding is that the enforcement mechanisms are very similar here. This is in line with what is in the model legislation developed by the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. And most of the 38 states that have, 30 states and territories that have these standards have followed fairly closely the model legislation, with the exception of how minimums are defined. That's very different. I mean, it's very different in a densely urban place like Massachusetts than it would be in Alaska. So each state has adopted sort of their own flavor for the definition of the minimums.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Other questions for Mr. Davis? Mr. Davis, I have a couple of questions. If providers are guaranteed to be paid at a set price point, whether that is as pegged as it used to be under the old regime of a percentile of usual and customary charges, or a new regime under this system where it would be some multiplier of Medicare, what incentive is there for providers to be in network, to sign contracts with insurance companies when they would be guaranteed to be paid out at some multiplier of Medicare if they are out of network?
Thank you, Chairman Bjorkman. That's a very good question. Pleased to have a chance to answer that. There are a number of benefits to being an in-network provider. One is that in most contracts, the insurer pays a higher percentage of whatever is found to be the reasonable and customary amount than they would to a non-contract provider. Oftentimes it's 80% if they're contracted and 60% if they're not. What that means to the provider right off the bat is that they need to chase their, it's probably not a good term, they need to require their patients to pay 40% of the bill rather than 20% of the bill. And it's easier to collect from a health insurance company, although it's not easy, easier than it is to collect from individuals. So that's one reason. Another thing that is very important is back in the day in 2014 and before, when very few providers were in network, there wasn't a cost to being out of network in terms of attracting patients and this financial differential that I just explained. But once all the providers moved in, and I say all in quotes, air quotes, it's about estimated about 90% are in network. At that point in time, leaving a network is very costly to a practice. You first have to explain to your patients why you're leaving and why now they're going to have to pay a higher percentage of the bill and why it's going to be more complicated for them. That doesn't make them very happy with their provider. Insurers have other disincentives that they have built in. For example, contractor providers may have a designated, at least they used to, a designated person that they could work with when they had issues. And if you're non-contract, good luck. You can email this email address, and we'll maybe get back to you. And if you are the one who, in a specialty that has dropped out or is not in, it's a very disadvantageous place to be. I won't name names, but there's a very popular family practice physician in Anchorage who was removed from one of the major carriers' networks with little explanation, and it has been devastating to her practice in terms of loss of patients and loss of revenue. So the fact of the matter is, when, as Senator Giesel explained, the standard in the bill becomes the reference point for a negotiation. But providers are very willing, in the most part, to agree to something less because they get something for being in network, the things that I just explained. There are other little things. They're in the directory, so someone goes to look for a provider, there they are. But it's a variety of things. So there's been some concern expressed, well, gee, if we have a standard and people have are being reimbursed as something less than the standard, they'll just drop their contract and go out of network and go for the standard. And I, based on my experience, I don't believe that that's true. There are always exceptions to the rule, but I believe the vast majority of providers would continue to see it to be their advantage to be in network if they can negotiate something reasonably close to the standard in the bill. There might be some catch-up that has to be done, because of the situation I described earlier, where there have been virtually no increases for the last 7 to 8 years while expenses have gone up.
Understood. As we look at the matter, of course, over the lifespan of the 80th percentile rule, there was a time where you had a large amount, an overwhelming percentage, I would think it's safe to say, of some specialties and providers that were out of network. And then there was a migration of people who came in network under the same regime. What was the cause for that action? Why did we change from so many people being out of network to so many people being in network?
Chairman Bjorkman, again, an excellent question. I'll give my best. That would be a great research project for someone. But I'll give you the world according to Jeff Davis why I think that happened. During the period between 2004 and 2014, a significant number of providers moved into Alaska, increasing the number in certain specialties and bringing new specialties that had not been there before. And I believe that one of the major reasons for the influx of providers is the 80th percentile regulation stabilized the financial situation. Prior to the 80th percentile, we had exactly what we have now, with insurers paying whatever they wanted to. So to move your practice into an environment where you don't know what you're going to get paid was not a very wise financial decision, and you were likely not to make it. After 2004, that changed. We saw, I think it was about 40% increase in the number of physician offices in Alaska. Well, the more you have of a certain of in an environment, the greater the benefit becomes of differentiating yourself by joining a network. That's one factor that I think happened. Another thing that happened was around, I think it was around 2012, the healthcare commission that was in place at that time, commissioned a study from Middleman that looked at relative compensation for physicians by specialty in Alaska versus other comparison markets. And what it found was a lot of discrepancy, that a number of specialties especially were being paid significantly more in Alaska than elsewhere. It didn't look at costs. It didn't look at take-home income. It just looked at charges. But that, I think, raised awareness that it was important for the medical community to respond to that. And part of the response was to, okay, we'll be part of the game now. We'll come in to network. And so they did. And it happened fairly quickly. And once the way this works in a market is once a few people move in, then there's kind of a snowball effect and others move in. If everybody's out, nobody comes in. It can stay that way for a long time, which it did in Alaska. But then once that changes, it's go time. And I think, Senator, that's also what we experienced here. So in my view, having been around since before there were any even network products in Alaska, those are the major factors that I'm aware of that I think influence the growth of providers in the network. And I do not see that going backwards with this bill at all, as I explained in your earlier question. Thank you.
Thank you. Last question. Someone who's out of network, is there anything that would stop them from charging even more than that proposed benchmark of 450% of Medicare? And then balance billing the patient for the rest?
Senator Bjorkman, another excellent question. There is nothing. They could charge whatever they want to charge if they're out of network. But the payment of the payment to on behalf of the insured person is going to be driven by the standard in the bill. The provider could then balance bill for anything over that if they're a non-network provider. That is not a very popular practice from the standpoint of people who are insured. So I think that if there's any other options, that would be short-lived, but that would be possible. Now, within a contract, there is no balance billing. The contract sets the rate, and all the contracts that I've ever seen require that the provider accept that rate as payment in full, whether part of it comes from the insured and part of it comes from the insurer.
As a person who has two balance bills on my desk that I need to write checks for, your assessment is correct, sir. Any further comments by members? All right, we'll go to our next invited testifier.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Hello?
Hello.
Can you guys hear me?
We can. So please state your name and affiliation and begin your testimony, please.
Hi, my name is quite an echo. My name is Carolyn Renee Roberts. So on there, CM and Renee Roberts. Let's see, how can I fix that?
Okay. I think you're signed in twice, Dr. Gross.
How do I say now? This one.
I think you just X out of it, or hit the little leave telephone up there.
And she's gone.
There.
Ostrich. Now we need you back.
Okay.
Let's see if you can get me back.
We can hear you. If you turn on your...
That's good enough.
Perfect.
So thank you for letting me speak today. I'm here as a physician who's practiced in Alaska for many years, actually 30. Well, I've been practicing for 36 years. I've been in Alaska for 25. I mean, I love caring for my patients here. And what I want to do is share with you what happened when you guys got rid of the 80th percentile, how it affected me, not in theory, but in real life.
Could you just state your name one more time for the record, please, ma'am?
Carolyn Renee Mercuris.
Thank you.
Sure. So one of your doctors here in Anchorage. So when the rule stopped being enforced, the impact for me was immediate. In the fall of 2024, in the fall, January is when it was stopped, my reimbursement dropped significantly. Even though I was seeing the same number of patients and I was given the same level of care, Alaska, as you know, is an expensive place to run a practice after paying rent, malpractice, supplies, and my employees, and all my employees had families. I found myself losing money by simply staying open. About every 3 months, I was having to put my own money into my practice just to keep it going. At the same time, the demand for care didn't slow, and the OB/GYN patients, they don't get put on pause. I have pregnancies, emergencies, complications, they keep coming. They require time, attention, and constant availability. The financial strain of this, combined with the emotional and physical demands of my what I have to do, became overwhelming. Not only did I want to keep working, but because the system no longer made it possible, I couldn't do it sustainably. Eventually, which was in the early of this year, I made the difficult decision to retire earlier than I had ever planned. I mean, I still had a kid in college. That decision wasn't just hard. It also meant fewer options for my patients who are already struggling to find care. Today, I still practice, but I do it as a locum. Alaska lost a doctor, not because the need disappeared, but because the math stopped working. When we talk about reimbursement policies, we're really talking about access to care and whether physicians can stay and about whether communities can depend on having the doctors that they need. I hope that this story puts a human face on this issue because these decisions affect real people on both sides of the exam room, and the cost of that is worth acknowledging. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. We'll move next to our next. Oh, are there any questions before we move on? Seeing none, we'll move to our next invited testifier, Teresa Lyons. Ms. Lyons?
Hello. And of course, now I clicked and I'm like, what am I supposed to say? Thank you, Senator Brookman and members of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. My name is Teresa Lyons. I'm an advanced practice registered nurse, an APRN. I'm here today as the president of the APRN Alliance, which is an umbrella organization that's made up of the four specialty areas of advanced practice nursing. There are 2,600 of us in the state, licensed in the state and practicing in the state. 2,400 of us are nurse practitioners. We're serving in primary and various different areas, including we manage people with chronic disease and we're in urgent cares. I'm reading the letter that Stephanie and I put together here and I don't want to miss anything. We are in a variety of areas. I was asked also to speak because I also, I'm a psychiatric nurse practitioner and I started my practice in 2012 and I was asked to tell my story. When the rescission of the 80th percentile came into play, it had a very, very significant impact on my small practice. I started my practice in 2012, it's a mental health practice, in Fairbanks. We wound up expanding into Kenai in 2021, and then 2 years ago, we opened a practice in Anchorage. I have 14 employees, six which are advanced practice nurses, all nationally certified. And between the three sites in Alaska, we see on average 200 people a week. Over a year, we have about 10,000 visits across all the state. We serve people as young as three, and our eldest is 98. We accept all kinds of varieties of insurance. We are Medicaid and Medicare providers, 63% of our practice is Medicaid and Medicare. The rest of our practice is in the commercial insurance. And like my colleagues, our practice has both been in and out of network, finding both situations financially unstable. And we too were impacted in 2024 when the insurance industry made the choices that they made. In network at the time, our reimbursements weren't really great. They're about 165 to 185% of Medicare, but at least we knew what we could kind of figure out what to do with. And we did not choose to go out of network, but kind of got bumped out of network. And then we actually chose to go back into network. I'm still pulling crow feathers out of my teeth as I sign the contract, and we'll be back in network with one of the larger insurance companies at the end of February. And we did it because our patients, our clients, our families that we serve needed access, and watching them struggle and our staff struggling with, well, we can't actually book you an appointment until you pay your account down, has been really brutal. But we are in business, and to keep our lights on, we have to figure out how we're going to do that. We really applaud the work that's gone into SB 121 with the substitute that's being put in place. And on behalf of the APRN Alliance, we are in support of this. It ensures that networks have minimum standards for providers, including the inclusion of sufficient number of licensed healthcare providers that provide primary care. This ensures that it identifies contracting regions of the state which will have full complement of providers and better access to care. Second, it ensures statistically credible method that will be used to determine allowable charges with a floor of 450%. And I did have to laugh. Currently, there is no negotiation with insurance companies. The contract is given to us, and we either take it or we leave it. Putting a floor for out-of-network could give us some negotiating ability and ensure that providers are able to actually negotiate a reasonable contract rate. Third, the bill ensures that there is an equity applied to the reimbursement rates for allowable charges for healthcare providers who are practicing within their scope of practice and their provider license. We thank you again for hearing this bill, and the APRN Alliance stands in full support to pass this bill out of your committee. And I am happy to answer any questions that you may have. We appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nurse Lyons. Are there any questions from committee members? Ma'am, I want to make sure I understood you quickly. Did you say that before the repeal of the 80th percentile regulation that your reimbursements were at about 165% of Medicare?
Yeah, in contract. I'm sorry, I shouldn't laugh out loud. My billing company had encouraged me not to be in contract at that period of time. And I said, I'm watching my clients really struggle. We'll go in contract. There's got to be some benefit here. Boy, did I learn that there is no negotiating. And you take what they offer you, and they will change. We'd get letters, and it's like, yeah, we're going to reduce your reimbursement. So, and our challenge in the kind of work that I do is not that we don't have enough clients. We quite frankly don't have enough clinicians. And trying to attract them and retain them into Alaska is no small feat.
Thank you, ma'am. We will go in any further questions. We'll go next to Carl Borick. Dr. Borick, I hope I'm saying your last name correctly.
That was pretty close. It's actually Bowrick.
Bowrick. It was a 50-50 shot I had there. Sorry.
Yeah. Not bad. So I want to say thanks to Senator Giesel for introducing this bill and to Mr. Davis for explaining it so well. My name is Carl Bowrick. I'm an OBGYN in Fairbanks, and with me is Sarah Van Ort, my office manager. I was born and raised in Fairbanks and started Interior Women's Health Clinic in 2003. Currently, my wife and I employ a total of 20 Fairbanksons, including seven practitioners, including mid-levels and doctors, and extensive receptionists, billers, office manager, and chief financial officer. Since the loss of 80% rule, we've seen a significant drop in reimbursement, and I was hoping the slide, the pictures of the bar graph were delivered to y'all.
We have them, sir.
The bottom line is those significant drop reimbursements are our bread and butter. We do on the order of 15 deliveries or obstetric-related activities every week. We depend on that to keep our clinic going. Those hysterectomies and bladder restructurings and vaginal repairs, they do that every week. And we just can't keep going on with the reimbursements that the insurance companies are now giving us. You can see the change in the hospital-based billing is approximately 20% decreased, and the clinic-based procedures is approximately 15%. So in addition to those numbers, which are not good, the largest insurer in Alaska has instituted a large reduction in reimbursement to mid-level providers. They're now only paying 75% of these already low reimbursements for nurse practitioners and about 80% for certified nurse midwives, even though they do exactly the same thing as a doctor would do. Needless to say, the price, this decrease in reimbursement, is not being passed on to the consumers. One kind of chilling example is that some of the insurers are not paying for things that we apply, such as implants or intrauterine devices. They're not paying us as much for those as they cost for us to buy. So meanwhile, clinic expenses have gone up considerably. The electricity, the water, the cleaning, the heating fuel, the supplies, the rent, all of those are going up. Our biggest expense is staff. For instance, receptionists' salaries have gone up over 20% over the past 5 years. The Senate Bill 121 is not a panacea. It's not going to make things as good as they were before the loss of the 80% rule, but it's going to help a lot in terms of negotiations. I have just a couple of examples I wanted to pass on while I've got you guys. A podiatrist who I know quite well retired last year because he was paying money to keep his clinic open. That leaves just one podiatrist in town. John Lopez, the neurosurgeon, he's the only one in town, is sometimes getting as little as 30% reimbursement for his highly technical and highly litigious procedures and surgeries in the hospital. The long and short of it is that I don't think healthcare, as we know it, can carry on under these circumstances. So please, if there are questions for me or my office manager, Sarah, please let me know.
Dr. Bowrick, thank you very much for your testimony. Are there any questions for the doctor? Seeing and hearing none, thanks again, sir. We'll move now to our final invited testifier, I believe, for the day, Ms. Debbie Ryan. Ms. Ryan, please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Senator and members of the committee. My name is Debbie Ryan, and I am a co-owner of a chiropractic clinic with a 70-plus-year legacy of serving Alaskans. For transparency, I also serve as the CEO for Alaska Chiropractic Society, representing chiropractic physicians statewide and working to protect patient access to conservative care. In that role, I hear far too often from providers who are retiring early, leaving Alaska, or unable to repay student loans, which can be as much as $250,000 when they get out of school, nor can they support their families because they simply cannot make a living practicing healthcare in this state anymore. Nor are we attracting new younger providers to Alaska. Today, I'm here to speak to you about how insurance affects healthcare, not only for providers, but for patients. When you look at the full picture, both sides of the healthcare equation are under serious strain. And let me share a few facts from my office. First, deductibles are extremely high. The highest deductible I've seen this year is $6,350, with coverage at 80% only after that deductible is met. For conservative care like chiropractic services, this often means that the patients pay 100% out of pocket despite paying significant monthly premiums. For patients with a straight copay, some of these copays are $85 and the insurer pays nothing and the patients are paying everything. Second, Alaska has a dominant healthcare insurer that functions as basically a monopoly. Over 10 years ago, that insurer implemented major fee schedule reductions, and that was even prior to the repeal of the 80th percentile rule. Some services were reduced by as much as 60%, while premiums have remained strong and increasing. Providers today are being paid less than they were 20 years ago. Think about that. If you had to get a paycheck that was less than what you got paid 20 years ago, would you be able to survive? When I reviewed my 2025 billings, that specific insurer paid only 36% of all claims that were submitted to the office or to our office. Patients paid 35% of the charges in addition to their premiums. As an in-network provider, my office was required to write off 29% of all charges submitted, nearly one-third of the care we provided because of contractual obligations. Let me be clear, our services are not expensive and they're not excessive. You may ask why we remain in network. The answer is simple. Many insurance plans in Alaska provide no coverage at all if a patient sees an out-of-network provider. Providers are effectively forced to stay in network just to serve their patients. And one concrete example of what insured care looks like today, there's a common chiropractic code. It's a CPT code 98940, which is a chiropractic manipulative therapy, which is CMT. In my particular office, that charge is $78. I just looked at an EOB that my biller gave me. The insurance company allowed $45.10 of that $78 charge. And keep in mind, that's probably the only thing that patient came in for that day. We were required to write off $32.90. The patient paid a $35 copay, and the insurance company only paid $10.10. The patient paid most of the cost plus their monthly premiums, and from my perspective, that is not meaningful insurance coverage. Years ago, the state recognized these issues and implemented percentage-based safeguards for out-of-network reimbursement. That system allowed providers to assess whether staying in-network was sustainable or whether they needed to go out-of-network to survive. When the safeguard was removed, control shifted entirely back to the insurer. Reimbursement is now dictated solely by internal fee schedules and payment policies. And by payment policies, when you talk about negotiated fees and fee schedules or percentages, what many people fail to realize is that these insurance companies develop payment policies, which are basically just their laundry list of things that they can use in your contract to get out of paying you for stuff. So they reduce they have a multiple payment policy. So if you have multiple procedures done on the same day, they start reducing them as they go down. There's the reduction for if a person is not a physician. And as the doctor said, if his nurse practitioner does that same service as he does, they get a reduction. Well, the service was done, the expenses remain the same, and yet the payment policies are dictating what we have to write off or what we have to put up with. So let me get back to where I was. I kind of veered off a little bit, and I apologize. I was getting very passionate about it. So the result of this is predictable. Providers are retiring early. They're closing their practices or leaving Alaska. We are a business like anything else. Providers facing rising costs for labor, rent, supplies, taxes, and compliance, which compliance is a huge thing for all of our offices these days, not to mention insurances, because now we have to have insurances that cover us when somebody comes in and hacks into us. Small practices must compete with hospitals and large systems for the same workforce. We often train staff only to lose them to larger organizations that can offer better wages and benefits. Because of the cost of doing business has grown and reimbursements have diminished, I currently operate with half the support staff I once had. So what does that mean? I'm 67, almost 68 years old. I'm sometimes wearing the hat of the front desk. I'm sometimes wearing the hat of my biller. I am sometimes wearing the hat of a chiropractic technician. I'm running everywhere except on vacation where I'd really like to be, or maybe even retired, because I don't have those options right now. I own this clinic. I employ people. My son is my partner. And so, you know, there's a lot of reasons why I continue to do what I do. This will protect patient choice by making Alaska a more viable place for healthcare providers to practice and remain. It'll allow us to make informed decisions about whether being in network with strict fee limitations or operating out of network with predictable reimbursements, which is sustainable. And using Medicare as a benchmark, you know, Medicare every year goes in and they evaluate every procedure, CPT code, and they decide what the value of that is. So using that as a benchmark is a really brilliant way for us to use to evaluate things in this bill. I just want you to know that I really appreciate the sponsors of this bill, and I appreciate you guys listening to this, and I know you're going to hear a lot about how it's going to increase healthcare in Alaska and stuff, but I think you may be surprised. I would say 99% of the providers in this state just want to be able to do their jobs, do the things that they were educated for, take care of their patients. We all love our patients, but I can't do it anymore. If things remain the way that they are, I will close this clinic down. We've been in business for 70 plus years. It's a really sad testament to the way that things are running right now. So I appreciate your time. I thank you for your service to Alaska and its citizens. And if you have any questions, please feel free.
Thank you very much, Ms. Ryan. I'm going to ask you a question, and I don't want you to feel caught off guard, but I'm genuinely curious about the answer to this question. So please don't feel like I'm trying to put you in any certain way. I'm thinking about plans that I guess in recent decades had just started to cover chiropractic care as something that insurance would reimburse. And as we look at things like other types of chiropractic that maybe are kind of less mainstream and potentially having health plans reimburse those, how, in decades past, how did a practice like yours, if you've been around for some time, how did you handle payment at that time in the past before health insurance would cover chiropractic care?
Well, it's funny that you asked that because I actually started seeing a husband and wife team back in 1963. I was 5 years old. And at that time, there were no reimbursements for anything, no workers' compensation, no health insurance, and really there was very little, if any, health insurance back then, or workers' compensation. Now we're pretty much included in everything. The only real, and any service that we are licensed to do in the state that's under our scope of practice can be reimbursed by pretty much everything, with the exception of Medicare and Medicaid. And that is because there's some federal hiccups in the way that things were written there. And so for Medicare, when a Medicare patient comes in our office, the only thing that Medicare will reimburse us for is if the patient is on an active case. They've fallen, they've hurt themselves, there's the possibility that they, you know, are going to get back to where they were before the fall, et cetera. And the only thing they're going to pay for is CMT, which is chiropractic manipulative treatment. It's 1 to 2 regions, 3 to 4 regions, and 5 regions. They don't even, Medicare doesn't even pay for extremities. Medicaid will pay for the same thing, the CMTs, but they do not cover exams either. So if a Medicaid patient comes to me, and believe me, I get calls every day for the services, because they're having headaches, they're having back issues, et cetera. The only people that we can see are children ages 6 to 20. And this is really important for you as legislators or senators to understand. I've been trying to get this changed with the state for many years because other states cover our services. And it's not an increase to services. It's actually a better treatment for certain things that are much more cost effective. So it would save the state money. So when a person calls me and they're not 6 to 20 and they want to, they're having issues, and I say to them, well, there's only 1 or 2 people who provide osteopathic care. So I try to refer them to them because there's no Medicaid benefit for them. And if that doesn't work, my only option is to send them to the emergency room. We all know how expensive emergency room care is. So I can't treat those people, and that needs to change. But every other insurance company covers our services. Whatever it is we're licensed to do, they cover our services in the state. And since we are conservative care, our rates are really reasonable. And people get back to work right away. They feel better right away. It's reducing opioids. It's reducing painkillers. It's reducing muscle relaxers. So, you know, we have a real place in Alaska to serve people. We just have some hiccups that we have to get past.
Thank you very much, Ms. Ryan. Appreciate your testimony today. Are there any other questions? Thank you very much. Senator Giesel, would you like to wrap up, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Senator Kathy Giesel. Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the people that called in and testified. I would point out to you, Mr. Chairman, that health care insurance premiums, what we pay for health care coverage insurance, have not gone down. They've gone up substantially. And yet, the reimbursement to the clinicians who are providing those services has plummeted in this state. Somewhere there's some money going somewhere. I won't speculate on where, but I think we kind of know insurers are profiting. Mr. Chairman, we have before us a rural health transformation plan, potentially. The goal of that is access to health care and increased workforce. Well, we're facing a crisis here because of the lack of a floor or mandatory reimbursement that allows clinicians to negotiate when they're trying to join a network of insurance. Mr. Chairman, I know one of the controversies related to this bill is the 450% of Medicare as the measure of what a reimbursement for an out-of-network clinician. As I said, Mr. Chairman, I first offered this bill in 2018. And at that point, I offered reimbursement of 300% of Medicare. I based that on a Milliman study, and it was mentioned by one, I believe Mr. Davis mentioned it. This is the 2016 study. The first study was in 2014. I'm happy to share this with the committee, Mr. Chairman. But in it, they actually talk about reimbursements of the various clinical specialists as well as primary care. My goal in 2018 was to protect primary care. That's the door into healthcare. If they're not being reimbursed enough to stay open, well, we're losing the battle because then people have to choose to go to specialists instead. But instead of a less expensive primary care where prevention can occur. Mr. Chairman, taking the number in this 2016 study and applying an inflation rate to it of anywhere from 30% to 40% would make that match number in this bill, instead of 450%, 350%. I am open, Mr. Chairman, to an amendment like that. It's important, Mr. Chairman, that we keep these clinicians here. And instead of having locums come in, that's someone that lives in another state, flies in, takes care of whoever's on the client list that week, then flies home. So, Mr. Chairman, that's the purpose of this bill, is to correct the huge flaw, the crisis that we're facing right now. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Giesel. I appreciate that. We'll talk about this bill more, and I'll kind of save my comments for that time as we'll get to our further. Oh, Senator Yunt.
Thank you. Through the chair, so you touched on something a minute ago that I've been thinking this entire time, right? We've got 4 or 5 years of data here showing that, you know, the payout to clinicians is going down and providers. But just as a guy living in Alaska, I haven't seen health insurance costs going down. And so I'm a data guy. I like to look at numbers. Could you please, you and your staff, come back the next time? We've got this showing costs or payouts to the providers going down. But if we could bring back some stuff that shows health insurance costs in Alaska the last 4 or 5 years during the same amount of time, I think it's going to tell a pretty obvious story, the same one we're probably all thinking, but it would be fun to see it on paper, because this model right here doesn't seem to be working, you know, so thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to provide that information. Thank you.
Very good. Senator Yunt, I'm afraid you've baited more comments out of me here, but I'll keep them brief. I think when we look at this issue and we look at the insured market versus the self-insured market, we learn a lot about what's happening with healthcare based on plan experience of self-insured markets. And those self-insured pools, they don't pay a Premera or another health insurance company. Their plan experience has to be paid for by the members of their pool. Their costs are also increasing substantially. So to explain that, where you're not necessarily dealing with a huge insurance company in a self-insured pool, alongside of similar experience in the insured pool, there has to be a reason for that to happen. And so during the period of time where Senator Giesel is talking about, where there was a recognition that the 80th percentile rule was not great, and if you ask many people, they would say it was the number one reason at the time that healthcare and health insurance costs were exploding in the state. People were saying, well, what do we do? Like, what can we do? There's more to say, but I won't say it now. So we started looking at things like this concept. At the same time, we have really the rise and really powerful nature of pharmacy benefit managers who are also exploding costs, and that force is real. And so the good senator has also done work in that area. We have similar cast of characters in the room today, and like all of these costs drive up premiums, and the cost of care and what people pay every day in premiums for their care, essentially it's a backdoor income tax to support very low Medicare and Medicaid reimbursement rates for providers. That's what's happening. And what's on the horizon is pretty bad. It's quite bad with federal cuts to Medicare and Medicaid and really what we're all facing here because of those, right? So, yeah, we have, 270-some million per year for 5 years that's coming in, but that's only a little bit coming back when you consider the massive cuts to Medicaid that we're looking at. So none of that is good news. More to come. Thank you very much, Senator. Take a brief at ease while we set up for the next bill. We're back on the record. It is 2:51 here in Senate Labor and Commerce. Next, we are taking up Senate Bill 163. This is our first hearing on this piece of legislation. With us today, we have bill sponsor, Senator James Kaufman, and his trusty staff, Takama Inoue, for an introduction of the bill. Senator, Mr. Inoue, welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please have a seat at the table here. And begin your introduction of the bill.
Thank you much, Chair Bjorkman and members. My throat's Chair Bjorkman and members of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. For the record, James Kaufman, Senate District F. Get my voice working. It went dormant there. I want to thank the committee, Chair and the committee, for saving this very exciting bill for last. it's perfect for a Friday afternoon. This bill is the son of a bill that we passed in the previous legislature. So if it sounds familiar, that's because the framework we're operating under today was created in the previous legislature. And that's where we created the process of every 2 years going through our accounts and looking for funds where we might have put money in the past that is no longer needed because legislation has moved on. Maybe the need for the accounting line that we created is gone. But what happens without a mechanism like this, we build up clutter. We have all these account titles that aren't really needed, and some of them sound really compelling. And when you start to think about repealing them, people look at them and go, my goodness, why don't we need that fund? And, well, it turns out because it was handled through some other process or the need for it was taken away by changing the statutes. And so over time, we accrue these unused accounts, and it builds up clutter, which is not good for purposes of transparency, for efficiency, for all the things that we like to do. There's no reason to keep this stuff on the books. So the process that was set up, every 2 years, Ledge Finance would go through the accounts, look for candidates to pursue further. We'd identify them. They'd get scored by a ranking system that was created in the prior legislation that we did. And then we'd come up with those candidates of funds that seemed to no longer be needed. And then we'd work with the departments, with OMB, with Ledge Finance to try and see what we could take off of the books. And the idea is every 2 years we keep doing this, the ledger just gets cleaner and cleaner, and we don't have dormant, out-of-date stuff. For example, we had in this latest first cut, we had an Exxon Valdez oil spill unincorporated rural community grant fund. It sounded really compelling. Boy, what is that? But it turned out, no, it could go because other things had taken care of the need for that. So the first part of the process is always to look and see, despite the name of the fund, is it really doing any work for us these days? And so with that, if there's any questions, I can take questions, or if the committee would like, the chair would like, talk about any way to go through the sectional and kind of explain what changed, we're happy to do either.
Sure. Senator Gray Jackson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Senator Coffin, for bringing this bill forward. But based on the fiscal note, it looks like there's no money in any of the funds.
Sometimes that's true. Increasingly, it's true because it's been swept out, but we keep the clutter on the books.
Right. Can I follow up?
Yes, please.
Thank you. So, I mean, like I just said, based on a fiscal note, it looks like there's no money in the fund, but is there any money in any of these funds?
Not in the funds that we've identified.
Okay.
When we started out on the process, there was money in some of them, but then, through the – I don't want to get into the complexities of the sweep, reverse sweep, and all of that. Money was taken out. So
okay.
At present, there aren't. But in the future, if an account does get funded and that money's sitting there, that's not a good thing if it's not needed. And so it would also sweep the funds and close the account if it wasn't needed.
One more comment, Mr. Cook.
Yes.
Right, because if there is money and funds that need to be closed, that's a bonus.
Right.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
If I may.
Yes.
And that's part of the reason why we created this two-year mechanism. If you recall, we've used the same process before. We create legislation that requires reports, and then time goes on. Do we still need people to work on those reports and publish them and ship them all over the state? Maybe not. And so now every 2 years we have that process running. And so we did the same thing with the accounts and to try and get down to doing what we really need to do. And if there was in the future, if there was an account that was funded, maybe we get in better times financially, and then we can sweep that money out if it's not needed. So it's transparency. If the public looks at our books, they're like, what is this money pigeonholed? There's a lot of people that think that, we're hiding money, and leaving these unneeded account titles out there is a good way to work through the process and improve really the transparency of government.
Thank you.
Senator Dump.
No.
Oh. I just wanted to mention that also we have Rob Carpenter with Ledge Finance, I believe, available to answer questions. I'm not sure if he's with us, but I believe he's there.
Okay. Yes. Rob is in the back. Thank you for sticking with us for this whole time, Mr. Carpenter. Are there any questions? The sectional seems straightforward to me. I think we could probably forego having Mr. Inouye read the sectional, but thank you very much for being here and being prepared. Any questions or desire to read the sectional? Hearing and seeing none, thank you very much. Appreciate your efforts in this. I understand that you may have also identified other funds that you would like to add to this list.
Through the chair, yes. There, you create the list of funds, and then you're trying to work out legislatively how can you clean all that up? Because we literally, it's kind of takes an act of Congress, so we create these over time, and then they're scattered all throughout the book. So we're looking at that. We may have an opportunity to bulk this up with even more that aren't needed and take a deeper cut through it. And we're currently working with Ledge Legal and Ledge Finance to do so.
Excellent. I think we'd be happy to entertain that.
Very well.
Thank you. Okay. Well, we look forward to that. And we, depending on the success and pace of work that you all are able to undertake with finance and legal, we may take this bill up again under bills previously heard next week. So we'll be in touch on that. So, okay. Any other closing comments, questions? All right. Hearing nothing further, we will set Senate Bill 163 aside for consideration at a future meeting. Our next meeting will be on Monday, February 2nd. I feel like it's been that day. When we will take up three items, Senate Bill 170, poll tabs, Senate Bill 211, and Senate Bill 81, as well as maybe bills previously heard. As there is no further business before the committee, we are adjourned at 3 p.m.